Got to give the people what they want. Got to give the people what they want. Well, hopefully, that's our intention today, to give you, our listeners, what you want. And if not what you want, well, at least we like to give what we believe you can use. Or even better, what you need. I'd be remiss if I didn't pause for a moment and say thank you for tuning in to another edition of Progressive News Weekly, where week in and week out on Thursdays at about this time, we bring you news and information that's gathered, as I like to say, called from around the world, typically, for the most part, in these United States. Today is no exception, and we have a show that, well, I believe that you'll appreciate because we have a continuation from last week. And so if you tuned in last week and you enjoyed the program and really reaped something from that, well, this week will certainly do the same for you. My name is Darryl Clark, and I do this out of the love for wanting to see my fellow human being be informed, enlightened, inspired, encouraged, empowered, and instilled, really instilled to make a difference. So, what's happening in the news? Well, I'd have to say politics as usual. Politics as usual. For those of you who happened to see the debate, well, sorry. Sorry about that. I just have to put it that way. Just keeping it real, as I always will for you. I did tune in to a portion of it, only because, well, we need to know the truths and the untruths. And there were more of the latter, I think, in yesterday's debate. But we'll talk about that a little bit later. For today, we have somewhat of a special treat for you as we open up with a, it looks like we're doing okay here, because last week we tried to open up with this gentleman, and we had, oh boy, it was like, okay, who is working against us today? But today it looks like everything is aligning very well, and we're going to be able to go to our first guest, as I said, which is a treat. So for those of you who are tuning in early, well, you're going to get the benefit of the treat. And I believe Cecil is dialing up our guest right now, and we'll just... we'll be able to get through. This is live radio, folks.
Hello.
Yes. As I said, this is live radio, and we just dialed in to catch Mr. Lawrence Ham, and he's a community activist, civil rights leader, and for those of you who are regular listeners, you know exactly who Mr. Lawrence Ham is, founder of People's Organization for Progress and overall crusader for economic equality, racial justice, and public civility for all Americans. Mr. Ham does not have much time, so we're going to get right into this, but he'll be joining us in the weeks ahead. Mr. Ham is going to speak to us about an upcoming event, an anniversary of an upcoming event, and whatever else he can share with us in the short time he has, and he's very much stated he only has about 5 minutes with us today. So, without further ado, Mr. Lawrence Ham, how are you doing this evening?
I'm good. How are you, brother?
Oh, we're fighting the fight, you know, and rolling with it, you know, with a few feints, upper hands, overhand rights, and hooks, and whatever we can get in there. You understand.
Right.
Tell us what's happening, Mr. Lawrence Ham. What's happening in your world?
Well, yesterday we had a major demonstration in Lyndhurst, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
Where yesterday was the one-year anniversary of the death of Kashad Ashford, who was shot to death by Lyndhurst police and state troopers. He was in a stolen car at the time, but he was unarmed, and according to witnesses, the car was not moving. And the police fired upon him, and they shot him 9 times in the head. I have never heard of anyone being shot 9 times in the head.
Me either, have I.
You know, and, you know, no one condones stealing automobiles, but if you read the New Jersey law statutes, the legal code for New Jersey, nowhere does it say that the penalty for stealing a car is death. And beyond that, no one authorizes the police to execute people there to apprehend criminals and bring them into custody so that they can stand trial and by a jury of their peers. So we took a bus, a completely full busload of people and several carloads of people, about 75 people in all, and we marched on the town hall municipal complex, which includes the police station, to demand, one, that the state attorney general make public all materials pertinent to the Keshad Ashford case. That case is not being handled by the county prosecutor of Bergen County. The case is being handled by the state attorney general because it involves state troopers who also fired upon and struck Keshad Ashford. But they're keeping all the information secret, and the family, since the day Keshad was killed, nothing about the case has been divulged to the family, and we think that's wrong. So, number one, we want the information for the family. And number two, we're calling upon the U.S. Attorney General for New Jersey, Paul Fishman, to officially investigate this case, because we believe that Mr. Ashford's civil rights were violated in the process. He should have been taken alive. He was unarmed. He was not firing. He had no weapon in his hands. He was not firing at police. I'm sure with as many police as were on the scene, they could have taken him alive. So we're calling for the U.S. Attorney General to open an official investigation into the case of Keshad Ashford. And those in your listening audience who might feel so inclined, I urge them to call and write the U.S. Attorney for New Jersey, Paul Fishman. He's located at 970 Broad Street at the Federal Building, 970 Broad Street in Newark. You can get his phone number out of the information and directory and ask that the case of Keshad Ashford be investigated. The second thing that
that name again is Paul Fishman. Let me just, because I'm going to repeat that at the end of the program. Paul?
Right. Fishman. F-I-S-H-M-A-N. Fishman. And
his position is what again?
He is the U.S. Attorney for New Jersey, and his office, the U.S. Attorney's office, is located at the Federal Building in Newark, which is 970 Broad Street. And so you can get the phone number out of information. The zip code is 07102. So we urge people to write and to call to ask Paul Fishman to open an official investigation into this case. There are actually four cases we want the U.S. Attorney to investigate in New Jersey. One is the case of, I just mentioned, Keshad Ashford. Two, the case of Abdul Kamal, who was unarmed, who was standing on the sidewalk when he was fired upon 15 times, hit 10 times by police. He had no weapon. He was unarmed. The only thing he had in his hand was a cell phone, and he was shot to death by the Irvington police. So it's the case of Keshad Ashford, Abdul Kamal, Jerome Reed, who many of your listeners might be familiar with that case through the video, the dash cam video that went viral, showing Jerome Reed getting out of a car with his hands up, and a black Bridgeton police officer, Brahim Days, firing point-blank range at Jerome Reed and killing him. And the last case is that of a 14-year-old boy of Trenton, New Jersey, Radaz Hearns. Fortunately, Radaz is not dead, but unfortunately, he was shot in the back 7 times by undercover police. According to witnesses, he had no weapon. He's a 14-year-old boy. I'm sure it didn't take 7 shots to subdue him, and one of the bullets is so deeply lodged in his pelvis that they can't go and get it because he would lose life in the process. So those four cases we want investigated. The other thing that's happening, we're coming up quickly upon the 20th anniversary of the Million Man March in the nation, the Million Man March of 1995 in Washington, D.C., which is probably one of the most historic events in contemporary African-American history. And there's going to be a 20th anniversary Million Man March. Justice or Else is the theme. There are buses leaving from all over New Jersey. The People's Organization for Progress, we have a bus that's going. If people are interested in riding with us, we're leaving out of Newark, New Jersey. And they can call POP at 973-801-0001. That's 973-801-0001. But there are buses leaving from communities throughout New Jersey. And the general number that people can call to find out the different places where buses are leaving is 973-624-5532. 973-624-5532. I believe that is both the number for the state organizing committee of the Justice or Else 20th Anniversary March. It's also the anniversary of it's also the phone number of MOS number 25 in Newark, New Jersey. But you can call there and get information on buses that are leaving it from all the different cities in New Jersey. Or people can go online, justiceorelse.com. www.justiceorelse.com. You can go on that website and find the contact information for buses that are leaving out of Plainfield and Union County and other cities throughout New Jersey. So right now, the 20th anniversary march is the major event that is in front of us. We want to try and bring out as many people in 2015 as we brought out 20 years ago in 1995. So I urge everybody to get on the bus.
I like that. Get on the bus. Let me ask you, one quick question, and let's pick it up next week, because I know we're going to try to promote this up until the actual event. For this particular event, and I've talked to a lot of folks naturally about it, What makes this, and this sounds like a very simple and obvious question, but there are those that are questioning this to say, well, why should I come out to this event? I want to know what took place between now and the last event that should drive me to come to this event. A tough question, so I don't expect an elaborate answer, but at 100,000 feet, and let's open up next week with that question, Brother Lawrence. Right. So,
well, if I could think of two good reasons why people should go to the Justice or Else March in Washington or any other march in Washington, the first one that comes to mind is the epidemic of police murder of unarmed black people across the country. Literally, thousands of unarmed black people have been killed by the police over the past decade. That's one reason that we should go, because, yes, we do have a problem in our community with homicide, of people in our community killing each other. But we pay the police to protect and serve, not to kill us unjustifiably. So reason number one would be the epidemic of police murder of unarmed citizens that must stop. The second reason would be the rise of white supremacist organizations and activity in the United States. If there's any reason why we should go to Washington for Justice or Else, it would be the murder of 9 black people by Dylann Roof in the church while they prayed. The whole black nation in the United, the nation within this nation, should be in an uproar until Dylann Roof is convicted and sent to jail. And if it were just Dylann Roof, that would be enough. But if people knew the statistics, they would be amazed. The most dangerous terrorist threat internally to the United States right now does not come from Islamist organizations. It comes from, according to the FBI, the largest number of terrorist acts are being committed by white supremacist and white nationalist organizations like the Ku Klux Klan, like these neo-Nazi groups, like these militia organizations, and others. People would be amazed if they could see the statistics on this. So it's not just the murder of the Emmanuel Nine down there in Charleston, South Carolina. It's murders that are taking place across the country of black people and other people by these groups. So those are two reasons. And I could go on and on and on. You know, to ask the question, why should I march, is tantamount to a discussion taking place during slavery and someone asking, why should I rebel? Because the parallels are striking. You know, people say, well, we can't rebel. Master got all the power. But people rebelled anyway, and if it had not been for those rebellions, which culminated in the Civil War of the United States, no telling how long slavery would have lasted and how much of a wretched condition we would be in today. Black people are engaged in an intergenerational project. We are striving toward the collective uplift and liberation of our people. And each generation must make its own contribution to this great project. And so we must continue to resist as our ancestors resisted. I also want to close with this, and I have to leave because I'm meeting it. I'll be voted out of office if I'm late another time. But remember that Tuesday, this Tuesday that just passed, was the anniversary of the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. And four little girls were killed in that church. But people don't know, 21 other people were critically wounded, including one of the girls' sisters, who's still alive today, Sarah Collins Rudolph. When we reflect upon what happened September 15, 1963, 2 weeks after the Great March on Washington, where Dr. King gave his I Have a Dream speech, it gives us a moment of pause to think of all the sacrifices that were made so we could enjoy what little freedom that we have today. So just as others had to make tremendous sacrifices, including lives, blood, sweat, wealth, and so forth, our generation must continue to struggle and make those sacrifices so that our children and their children can have a better life. And on that, brother,
I'm
going to say good night.
All right, my brother. Good night, and thank you for the time, and thank you for the information. That's a great platform for us to keep going on. I'm going to just let folks know how to reach out to you and share the information. All right, Brother Lawrence. Take
All
care
right.
and tell
Peace.
The folks at Pop I said hello and keep on moving. All right,
All right,
that was Brother Lawrence Ham. For those of you who just tuned in, let me just give a little bit of background who Brother Lawrence Ham is. I truly believe that Lawrence Ham, who's been in the fight, who's been in the trenches for the last 30 years, is someone that is making a difference, will continue to make a difference, and at some point will be appreciated as one of the perennial movers and shakers in terms of making a difference in this century. And I know that's a strong statement. Many may kind of raise an eyebrow, but you'd have to look at the body of work that Brother Lawrence Ham has done. You have been treated to hear this man. It's akin to many of the civil rights icons of the 60s to tune in and hear firsthand from Lawrence Ham. Mr. Lawrence Ham, just not to go off too badly on this, and not badly, but I should say just not to go off too much. He's been in the struggle for almost 40 years. Don't misunderstand his energetic and very active voice. He's been in the trenches. He is a virtual historian on the works of Martin Luther King and is one of his greatest inspirations. He's recognized throughout the state of New Jersey and quickly gaining recognition nationally. He is the founder of one of the fastest growing grassroots community, civic and civil rights organizations in America, known as People's Organization for Progress, POP. They have numerous chapters in New Jersey and are looking to expand. And it's all an advocate-related activities for African-American people, and actually the cause for all human rights. Because as I like to say, and Brother Lawrence would surely appreciate being an advocate and inspired by Martin Luther King, we are all caught in an inescapable web of mutuality. And in that inescapable web or network of mutuality, we're tied in a single garment of destiny. So whatever happens to or affects one directly affects all indirectly. I can't be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. And you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. And this is what Martin Luther King called the interrelated structure of reality. And the sooner we as human beings understand that, the better off we will certainly be. So it's not just a black thing. However, blacks are disproportionately being affected by that imbalance in the state that we're in as humans right now. And yes, we know there are lots of folks suffering around the world. What's happening in Syria and other places is horrendous. I understand. So, with that said, Brother Lawrence will be joining us at the top of the program for the next couple of weeks, up until the Million Man March. And so that's what civic and community organization is all about. With that in mind, for my listeners who have been regular listeners over the years, you know that I have founded also a civic organization, and it's through a local here in New Jersey in Plainfield event that I do once a year that we bring about awareness on a human level, and that is my 5K, 1 mile event, walk, run for life. And some ask, well, Daryl, is this for cancer? Is it for diabetes? Is it for hypertension or lupus? What is this event for? And I clearly state that my organization came together for the life of our community. And that's what it means. And I encourage you across America, do something, start something, make something happen. Because collectively, there's a synergy that can certainly supersede any and all obstacles that we're faced with. And so you can get more information if you're in the tri-state area around October 17th. That's a Saturday, and it's also a holiday weekend. So if you're in the tri-state area around Plainfield, New Jersey, you can get more information at plainfieldwalkrun.com. That's P-L-A-I-N-F-I-E-L-D, walkrun.com, all one word, no spaces. Check us out. It's a fundraiser to encourage and inspire our youth to have greater self-esteem. It's to highlight the environment, the community in which the event is taking place, which is a predominantly minority community, which is making strides to self-sustain itself and uplift itself, which is what all such communities need to be doing. It is intended to also emphasize health and wellness, which disproportionately in the minority community is adversely affected. So you have more in the African-American minority communities that have greater occurrences of the major and minor illnesses, but especially the major imbalances, diseases, high blood pressure, diabetes, cancer, and arthritic conditions. And a lot of that, of course, goes back to stress. And so it's a proven fact that exercise benefits all of the above. And so that's what this event is about, and we call those pillars, pillars for life. And that fourth pillar, we have five, is for unification of the community. Most communities are divided. As Brother Lawrence mentioned, yes, we have high incidences of black-on-black crime. Not that that's an excuse for our so-called civil servants to begin to take pot shots at those within the community they're there to serve and protect. So until that community begins to unify, that situation will continue to escalate. And so the fourth of five pillars of my event is to unify and engage the community through a wonderful, high-profile, premier event that's done at a very professional level that's enjoyable for all ages and backgrounds and creeds. And then the fifth pillar is we raise funds, and every dollar goes back into the community. So again, it's plainfieldwalkrun.com, and of course I'd be remiss if I didn't give a plug for my own foundation. And it's coming up October 17th right here in Plainfield, New Jersey. So with that said, speaking of community advocacy, we're picking up, as I mentioned at the top of the program, from last week's program. And with that, returning as well as Larry Hamm. Actually, Larry Hamm was not able to join us last week, for those of you who did tune in, as you know. We had all sorts of network problems and technical issues where we weren't even able to bring Lawrence to the airwaves. And for what he had to say, it was enough to make a person paranoid. But as you can see, we never give up. That's just one of our mottos. We never give up. And I encourage you to be the same way. Never, as long as you have a breath, give up on any worthy goal. And so with that, we had last week joining us Mr. Kevin Porter, Dr. Porter, out of Texas. And he's certainly a true friend of Progressive News Weekly, subscribing to all of the precepts of Progressive News Weekly, speaking truth to freedom, making a difference, being inspired, sharing and caring, and doing the right thing for his community. Mr. Kevin Porter is an author, he's an engineer, he's an educator. Most importantly, though, he is a longstanding child advocate, primarily serving at-risk African-American males. And he's been at this for more than a couple decades. Another brother in the trenches doing that which is right and righteous. He has a mentoring group that he's founded and he's the director of, called Man-Made Mentoring. And he's participated in numerous other mentoring programs and organizations in an effort to switch children's mindsets from street to embracing intellect through classroom learning. And it's just such an honor and a pleasure and energetic thrill whenever Mr. Porter and I can share the airwaves and just encourage folks to follow the model. I want to talk a little bit today about his recent book, Angry Little Men, Hypermasculinity, Academic Disconnect, and Mentoring African-American Males. You see, the males of our society are those that typically lead it. And for my female listeners, this is not to be chauvinistic. A male has a role and a female has a role. And it's my belief that those roles should not be blurred. If it were not the case, and I challenge anyone, please call in, let's have some dialogue, then why would there be an oak tree, a pine tree? Why would there be an apple, a grapefruit? If they didn't serve different purposes, then why would they exist? It's a simple premise. I would challenge anyone to. This isn't to be homophobic. I'm not going to get into the gay and lesbian thing to say, oh, he's heading down this track about, you know, he was supposed to be Adam and Eve and not Adam and Steve and all the other little anecdotes you hear people talking about. I'm not even getting into that whole discussion at all. I have an opinion about it, but that's not where I'm coming from, and I don't even concern myself now, this moment, to get into that dialogue. I am talking about a man and a woman and the differences that exist and why they exist. There are attributes not just on a physical level, but on a spiritual level. And this isn't about religion. I don't care if you're Muslim or if you're Jewish or if you're Hindu or Christian. It does not matter. This is a spiritual difference as to why these two beings were created. Whether you believe in the Big Bang or you have some religious affiliation. Because if you believe in the Big Bang, then you understand that there are neutrons and protons and electrons, and that they're different, and they serve different purposes. And because they're different, by the sheer nature of that, they have different purposes. So I would submit to anyone to please call in and let's have some intellectual dialogue. The number is 347-838-9142, 347-838-9142. And I'm saying all of that to say, coming back to our guest, Mr. Kevin Porter and his book. And although it seems to focus on the young black male, you can't talk about daylight without acknowledging darkness. You can't talk about darkness without acknowledging daylight. You can't talk about hot unless you acknowledge that there's something opposite, something other than hot. So in the sense that he's talking about the black male, just that alone, you can't ignore the fact that there's a counterpart. There's a female aspect to what he's talking about. And we haven't gotten into this depth of his book yet, but I know it resides there. We haven't even had this, but I know it has to exist because it does exist. And so I want to get a little bit about what his book is about. And I'm looking forward to having some of this dialogue. But before we do that, he and myself and some others who have been guests on the program over the years have made a commitment that we're going to galvanize. We're going to do what we can to galvanize as individuals, heads of organizations, to make a difference through a synergy, through a national synergy. And we've had numerous guests to come on and talk about the importance of that, i.e. Dr. Eddie Taylor, you know, who has written his latest book, The Day the Crabs Got Out, The Restoration of Black America, where he talks about one of the things that have to happen to help get Black America out of this devastating, regressive error that it's in. That's ERA, by the way, not ERROR. Is for those organizations that influence numbers of people to come together. And so, Dr., and I affectionately call Mr. Kevin Porter, Dr. Porter, is going to talk a little bit about some of the things that he's doing before we get into a little bit more of his book. So, Kevin Porter, thank you for again joining us with Progressive News. You are truly a family member and a mainstay of Progressive News, and so I always look forward to the time when I can dialogue with your intellect. How are you doing, Mr. Porter?
I'm good, Brother Clark. It is good being back on the show, good talking to you, and it was outstanding listening to Brother Lawrence Ham. I really, truly enjoyed his conversation. He is a pioneer, and you can tell that he has an old spirit, and he's been working very hard. And as we talk about our communities and what we need to do, sometimes we have to take that talk and put it into action. And POP, Lawrence Ham's organization, is putting it into action. And he talked about the lives that have been killed and devastated as a result of police. And it's all over America. And we as a people have to realize that despite the fact that we may live in various communities that may not have predominantly black population, that it could happen to us at any point in time. And the reason why it can happen to us at any point in time is that because we still live in a society that is energized by racism. We still live in a society that is still fearful of African-American people. And we, as a collective group, have to prepare ourselves to protect ourselves and our families and our community through action. And one of the things that I like about your program is that you are progressive, and your program helps generate the energy for people to get active. And a lot of times we listen to radio, we read books, we look at the news, we talk to our coworkers about what needs to be done or who's going to do this or who's going to do that. But we need to take responsibility and step out there and be that agent. And I've been doing that, and it takes effort. And sometimes you get discouraged. But your community is a place where not only do you live, it's a place that you should thrive and grow. And one of the things that I try to do is be active in my community. And being active means that you have to be a part of the organization. You have to know the children in the community. I volunteer. One of the things I do, and I mentor, but part of my mentoring is being active at the school. And these schools are schools that my children have went to, but now my children are at other schools, high school, and I'm still volunteering at their middle school. And that's because I truly believe that we can have an impact anywhere. We can influence people's lives anywhere, whether we have family members that attend a certain school or attend a certain church. You can be active anywhere. That means on your job. That means in your church. That means in your other organization. So what I took upon myself is I went up to the schools and I got to know the principal, and I told him about what I wanted to do, and I knew that there's a shortage of African-American males in the school. I knew there was a shortage of African-American males that volunteer, and I also knew that there's a shortage of African-American males on the Honor Society, whether that's the National Honor Society or the Junior Honor Society. One, the Junior Honor Society is in your middle school, the National Honor Society is in your high school. And we might look at that and say, why did he pick the National Honor Society as a barometer? And the one thing that I know about my people is that we're very competitive. We are very competitive. And if you look at sports, you can see that we're very competitive. We're competitive in basketball. We're competitive in football. We're competitive in baseball. In school, for some reason, we have downplayed the pursuit of academic excellence. And I know why that reason is. Because in sports, if you're good, you're considered to be cool and popular. If in school, if you're good, you're considered to be nerdy or acting white. And we have to realize that that philosophy is flawed. And the only way we can realize that is to show examples of why that is flawed. And when I deal with young men, I try to deal with them in their on their level. And then on their level means I have to be able to show what being cool is or what having swag is or who gets the attention. And one thing that people realize is that when you're popular, you should be able to command the respect of everyone, not just the students. When you're smart, you command the respect of everyone, including the teachers. And that's what we are destined to be if we are guided to that. So I'm in a program at one of the middle schools where we are involved in the academic bowl every January, and we've been doing this for the last 4 or 5 years. I start off in October. I'll be starting in a couple of weeks. I'll meet with the parents in September, end of September, and I'll give them a spiel about the academic bowl and why we're trying to pursue academics. And I tell them, just like your kid, when I was 12, 13 years old, only thing I wanted to do was play sports. I wanted to be good at sports. But I knew that I had to go to the classroom. So while in the classroom, you can't just not do work, so you want to be good in the classroom. So I had to teach these young men that there's two sides. I call it, you know, sometimes I call it code switching. Sometimes I call it what you do on the outside and what you do on the inside. On the outside, you play. Outside, you play ball. On the inside, you're more reserved. and you focus on your academics. Can you do both? Yeah, because there's a time and a place for everything. And that's the message that we need to give to our young men. Now, why aren't they picking up this message in a regular classroom? Well, the classroom is full of teachers, and probably predominantly white teachers, and probably predominantly white female teachers, who don't understand the bravado or the hyper-masculinity that a young man may have. When I talk about bravado, I'm talking about that boyish attitude that I'm a man before they even reach puberty. They feel like they are a man because they play with their peers and they roughhouse and they play sports and they look at sports and they feel like this is the way to get respect. However, when they use these same attitudes and bravado in the classroom, it doesn't tend to win them the same accolades as it does on the ball field. So I have to teach these young men that you can still be a champion, but you can be that champion in the classroom. And we need to prepare them to be champions in the classroom. How do we go about that? We go about it in the sense that we have to teach them that in order to be a champion, there's certain things you have to do. When we think about sports, you don't think about somebody just, the coach telling you, no practice, all we're going to do is show up for the game. No, you have to practice. You got to execute. You got to perform. You got to perform at a high level. You have to be prepared. There's so many similarities between sports and the classroom. In order to be successful in the classroom, what do you have to do? You have to do your homework. You have to come to class. You have to be engaged. What does being engaged mean? You have to be in tune to what the subject is. You have to be prepared to ask questions. You have to be alive. You have to be energetic. You have to be passionate if you're going to be successful. Classroom champions cannot be passive. Football champions are not passive. And football champions play till the end. Ask the New England Patriots. They didn't give up. They continued to play to the end. And we ask the same thing of these young men. You have to prepare yourself for homework. You have to prepare yourself for tests up until you take the test, because it's that serious. Because what you're trying to do is you're trying to mold your mind into a champion. Champions work hard. When you are an athlete, you see athletes running. You see athletes lifting weights. You see athletes studying the playbook. You see athletes practicing. When we want to be champions in school, we need to take that iPad and that iPod and that iPhone and that computer away, because that's not being a champion in the classroom necessarily. That may be some free time that somebody may need, but we need to prepare them for being champions in the classroom, meaning that when they get home, we need to have them reading. There shouldn't be a day while school is in session that a child is not reading or doing one subject matter. That's preparing them to be a champion. And I contend that every child wants to be a champion, but most are not challenged to be a champion. Most young men will allow a coach to scream at them, holler at them, and tell them to do whatever he needs to do just because he wants to make that team. He wants to be on the team. He wants to be recognized. He wants to be a part of something great. But dare we challenge a young man in the classroom to be the best that he can be? And we haven't done that. We haven't challenged these young men. And when you call these young men out and they realize they haven't given what they have, they tend to work a little bit harder, a lot harder. Because the young men I deal with, they're just like young men in any other community. They will try to get over and do as little as possible if you don't ask them. But as soon as you let them know that you understand, you've been there, you played that game, and you understand that they aren't giving their best, and you continue to challenge them and continue to challenge them, then some of them will make that mark. Then soon the rest will come. And our community is in need of men challenging these young boys. And that's one of the things that I'm asking your listeners. If you're out there, If you have a child in high school or middle school or elementary school, make it a point to go up there once a month. Then go up there once every 2 weeks. Then try to make a visit once a week. And then try to get involved with going into the class and saying reading for 30 minutes. And then preparing for some type of academic contest. And then possibly doing Black History Month, which you see very little of, helping putting on a Black History play. That's how we get involved. That's how we hold our children accountable, and that's how we get involved into the schools. But Clark,
I love it. Hello?
Yes, sir.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I got you.
I love that. I love that philosophy. And what I wanted to ask you was, and what I'm going to ask you is, getting back to your book, a lot of your focus is on our young Black boys, our young, soon-to-be Black men. And I specifically said Black boys, because I think one of the problems we have, and you say angry little men,
mm-hmm.
is we're putting boys in the context of men.
Right.
It was Naeem Akbar that, I want to say 20 years ago, in his book Visions for Black Men, really instilled something in me. You're not born a man. You're born a boy. And don't you forget it. And then once you turn 18, you still may not be a man. You're just able to do certain things legally. There's more to being a man than turning 18. And so I wanted to address, as your book talks about angry little men, hypermasculinity, academic disconnect, mentoring African-American males, what is your take on the perspective that communities are taking with these boys? I have to catch myself and not even say young men. Some of these children are 11, 12,
yeah.
gang-banging. They're boys.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me try to elaborate on that, and I appreciate the question, and that's why I call them angry little men. They give the perception that they are men, but they're little angry men. And I've used that term not in the sense of maturity. I use that term in the sense of their imitation of a real man or what they consider a real man. And I don't put the blame on them because our community has left them alone so they don't have a true image of a man, and they make up this image of a man that they don't get to see. Because guess what? There's not a father in the house in most cases. There's not an African-American man at the school. Only man they may see is the coach, but they don't see one in the house. They'll respect the coach because he has something dangling over their head. But our culture has forgotten to raise these boys to be men, and their perception is they're men. But they're not. And what I wanted to address is the fact of the behavior. The behavior looks like an angry man. When you see a young boy, when you drive in the hood, and I had that bravado, and the bravado is I can walk where I want to walk, and I can look you up and down. I don't care if you're the police, the principal, or whoever. You can't touch me. That resembles not a humble child. That resembles someone who thinks they have authority. I didn't have a job. I didn't have a room. My mama bought my clothes, and I'm thinking that I had control of something. I was misguided. I was acting like a man that I thought a man should act, because I was presenting this bravado of toughness. And it's often done to protect our fractured self-esteem. In our community, sometimes when you are left as a young boy and don't have a man, you have to pretend that you're the man of the house. You know how we used to pretend like we're playing cops and robbers, cowboys and Indians? What is going on, these young boys are pretending like they're men. They're pretending like they're the man of the house. That's why the dialogue between the mom and the young boy seems more like a husband-wife thing as opposed to a mother-son. And that, that hyper-masculinity, it tends to become out of control. I feel you got a question here. You wanted to ask something else?
Wow. I was just saying that I've always thought about that. When you have that single-parent household, you have some single parents, so I don't want this to be misconstrued, and I'm talking about females, because there's a number of single-parent male head of households, by the way, folks. You need to know, it is the minority. There's some 20 to 30% head of households who are men, single. And I think some people don't realize that that number is that high. And it's growing, by the way. And of course, that happens for various reasons, which we can get into. But I hear you say that, and I think about something that has always been on my mind, that you have a significant portion of head of households, single head of households, by females who have that relationship not because that's what they're nurturing, but because that male is driving that. That
right.
Teenage, that 15, and probably even younger, 13, 14-year-old, who's hanging out with that male role model, as far as they know, who are gangbangers or who are often misled themselves out in the streets and running their households, and it becomes this cascading avalanche effect that perpetuates in the community, and these boys take that attitude home and think that they're supposed to run their households. And as a 13 or 14-year-old, I think you have a number of women who are intimidated by their own children.
Yeah. I think it's more, it could be called intimidating, and I'll just give you an example, a personal example. When my mother called me, my younger brother is 10 years younger than me, so when I was 22, he was 12, and I got a phone call from my mom, and she said, "I'm through with him. I can't do nothing else with him." And that's speaking of my brother, because she said he won't listen to me, he won't do what I say, do, he talks back, and that kind of thing. What my brother had learned over time, and that time may have been from the age of 5 until the age of 12, that it became a game. And the game was, she may say, she's going to do this to me, but she doesn't follow through with it. Or I may say, I don't feel like doing it, I can't do it, and I come up with excuses, and she takes those excuses. And part of it is the fact that a mom is trying to be both the mom and the dad, possibly both the one who's given the discipline and the one who's given the love, and it's hard to find a balance. That's why it's so important to have two people involved in the life of the child, because, you know, one shouldn't be always the discipline. You got to have love on both sides. But sometimes, even in my household, and me and my wife, we've been married for over 25 years, three kids, sometimes we get caught in a pinch where, you know, the little cute girl is saying something and I may chastise her and she's not responding the way I need, and Mama Bear comes in here and, you know, puts her in check. Or sometimes my son may do something where my wife cannot really get to him, and I overhear it, and then I have to come and put it in check. So we support each other. And that, because kids are going to try to exhibit their personality and exhibit their power or what they think they are, because every child does. But what has to happen is there has to be some balance, because we all smell ourselves at some point in time. But there has to be some balance, and that balance has to coincide with love and discipline and rules and boundaries. And not saying that we're always going to be right, but if we try to support each other and try to do it based on right thinking, then we can hopefully produce a child that becomes a better citizen and not a child who becomes a menace to society. And what we see in the community is a lot of young men, African-American young men, who have continued to play their mom at home, go to school, play the system at school, haven't learned a thing, and then they become a menace to society because that's all they know. It's about game. And nobody has challenged them or checked them and made them realize that the route they're going, we ain't buying it. Because a man will tell another young man at a certain point in time, we're not going to have that, and you're not going to cross that line. Because I've been there, and you're not going to cross that line. And I think young men understand that. That's why they don't cross their coach. You show me a good ball player who tries to check his football coach. But then you show me a bad student who checks his teacher. They do it all the time.
Good point.
So what we're trying to do, when I look at this angry little man, is the imitation. They're not men, but they try to imitate it because they have been given that imaginative role of a man of the house. Or you know, you got to act like a little man, and then they start boasting this bravado and thinking that they are doing something. They're not paying no bills. They're not working. They're not doing anything in the house. Most of them ain't doing no chores. And most of them are not doing well in school. So they don't earn the right of being called any kind of man. But I used it to make a point because that's what people used to say I looked like when I was going to cafeterias. The cafeteria lady said, "Why you don't smile? You look like a little angry man." And I was like, I couldn't smile because in the hood, you better let folks know I ain't the one to be something to mess with, okay? Because I was the good, smart kid, but I didn't tell folks I was the smart kid until it was time to graduate. Because they don't know what you do because they don't see your grades, right?
That's
so
right.
You can play a certain role, and that's basically what I did. I played a role to survive in the Kansas City, Missouri. But I think we have an opportunity. Go ahead.
You know, it brings me to mind the book, which is excellent. First of all, how can someone get their hands on the book?
Well, you can. It's offered at Amazon.com, and it's Angry Little Men, or you can go to African American Images. .com and order it online there. But it's available, and it's my first book. I'll read it again occasionally when I'm thinking about how to develop a program, or if I see a situation with kids, or I get some advice to parents and counselors or what have you, because it's something, and I focus on African-American males because African-American males have been predominantly over the last 40 years at the bottom of the academic scale. But this affects any male, but it affects us in a greater proportion because if we don't have the academic skills, we're not going to get the nod for a job. If a white male may not have some of the skills, he may have the family resources or the family tradition to make it. He may not have to be excellent in school. And my example is, you know, when I go to work, I'm the only one with 3 degrees in my R&D building, okay, research and development. My boss, VP of R&D, you know, and I can go on and on. But I, you know, tend to know that we need to have our stuff together if we're going to participate in this game called life. And the only way we get it together, we got to get it together in the classroom. And that's why this book was written for, to help mentors, parents, counselors, and teachers. We got to, it's not the fact that these young men are growing up in poverty or born up in criminal communities. It's the fact that this bravado prevents them from engaging in school. Because they're two conflicting attitudes. You can't be a strong, hard man and be a classroom king. You can't be top of the class in your math class if you're not answering questions. But the
how does this book help
allow you to engage?
How does this book help women? How does it help girls?
Well, I think what it does, it paints a picture of what these young men are, what they're exhibiting, why they exhibit this behavior. And it's a developmental process for youth. It's because of something that happened early on, the way they communicate early on, and it's allowed to grow, and it grows out of control. So these young men start saying, hey, mama, I want to wear my pants like this. Oh, I want to get these shoes. Oh, I want to get this. And they start dressing and mocking. And if nobody captures it and identifies it with a trying to be show this bravado or what have you, then they will continue to escalate. Hey, mama, I don't have no homework. We didn't do anything. And the grades reflect it. Oh, I don't like that teacher. That's bravado, you know. Why you don't get engaged with the teacher? It's important. You will do what it takes to be successful. If sport's important, you don't have a problem with asking the coach, can I get in the game, right? Or when am I going to play, coach? But when you ask a student, ask the teacher how to do this problem, they won't do it. So women need to understand what it looks like. Maybe not exactly what we call it, but what it looks like. And how to handle it. And you handle it like this is just an image that they're trying to make you believe that they are a little man, but they're not. You're still in control. And that's the problem. When they start acting a certain way, you think, well, I guess he has a good way. He says the teacher doesn't like him. He says he doesn't have any homework. But how'd you get this 70 in class? I thought you said, oh, mama, well, you know. Well, he got 3 A's, and one of them is in gym, and one of them is in art, and one of them is, you know, that's unacceptable.
Hmm.
So parents, male and females, need to call them out because they're acting like little men, because that is part of the development of human personality. It is to try to emulate that next level. The next level for a boy is a man. And until you allow a boy to stay in his place, he will do as you say. He will give you some fight, but he will do as you say, because as a parent, you have control over the purse string. You have control over who they when they come and go, over iPad, iPhones, Michael Jordan, all kind of stuff. That if you're not performing at a high level, then I can't do this for you because I'm the adult and you're the child. When you get a job and you get a family, you can make demands. Until then, I do it.
What's the biggest challenge you find in your mentorship? You're a professional mentor, have been doing it for decades in your organization. What are some of the biggest challenges you find in our black youth in establishing a mentor relationship?
Excuses. Every young man, every African American man has an excuse. What I want you to do next time you see a young man, ask them for their grades or what kind of grades they got or how they doing in school. And then ask them why they're not getting A's on certain things. Or if they're in eighth grade, ask them are they in the honor roll, on the honor society, not the honor roll. Because the honor society means that you had kept your grades at a high level for a long period of time, not just for 1 6 weeks out of 3, for a continuous 6 weeks. So what I find is that I get a lot of excuses why they can't get certain things done. But if I ask a young man if he plays sports and if he's starting and, you know, y'all have football practice, they get excited about that. So what I try to do is make them compete. And what I tell these young men is, and what they, you know, I set them up. Because what I remind them is, I played football in high school when I was captain of the football team. I played baseball in high school. I was captain of the baseball team. I went to school, and I graduated number two out of my high school. And my high school was 100% black. Now, you add all that together, that means that this guy must know what he's talking about. And I had some friends that weren't doing some of the, you know, both my friends were not on the honor society. They didn't even, I don't even know if they ever made the honor roll. Both my best friends, I don't think they did. Wouldn't even matter. We never talked about grades. Never. Because in the streets, you don't talk about it. But as an adult, I know what to look for. And I know I've been blessed to lead my community, so I'm trying to give back. Michael Jordan knows how to win championships. I'm not going to talk to Charles Barkley about how to win a championship. I'm talking to Michael Jordan. Why? Because Michael Jordan did it. Kevin Porter knows how to be a outstanding athlete. He knows how to be an outstanding academic guy. He knows how to go to school, to college, and do whatever he did, get a fellowship to go to grad school at Georgia Tech, then work in the community. I understand that. So if you want to ask somebody, you want to ask somebody that knows how to get there. So that's the value that I try to give to these young men. And I give it to them in a humble, you know, I'm humble and I know I've been blessed. I don't give it arrogance. I know, and that's why I try to help, because I know I owe a lot of people for where I've been, because it could have been me. Both my best friends, we took pictures in seventh grade and we thought we was all that. Both of them are gone, dead. One was in my best man in my wedding, dead. The other one died at 19, got killed at 19. So that's real. That's real saying, God watch out for me, and he's expecting me to do some things. And I ain't finished yet. I'm just getting started.
Last thing before we close it down, I appreciate you heading up this effort to galvanize organizations, and not next week, but the following in October, we're going to begin to bring on board fraternities. For our listeners who are listening live or in the archives, if you know an Alpha or a Kappa or a Q or a Sigma or a Delta or an AKA or a Zeta, have them call in. Give them the email. Forward the email to them, because we're going to begin to galvanize. And that's just on the Greek organization level. We're going to take this to the non-Greek civic and community black organizational level, the Frontiers Organization, NAACP, SNCC,
we have to come
Urban
here.
And so I thank you, and I'm looking forward to when we really get in the trenches with this, because I do believe that it can and will make a difference, as you know, you've outlined in your letter, in your proposal. And so I'm really looking forward to that. Where did you come up with, in your book, and I encourage listeners to look up Brother Kevin Porter and his book, and go and get it and share it. Where did you come up with the code concept, CODE?
Well, I knew that there's something that is missing from the young men and the teachers. And a lot of times kids are in classrooms and they're receiving the same information that other kids who are successful in. And the reason why our kids don't aren't as successful is that they don't connect with the teacher. the teacher just goes and presents a lesson, what have you. So they have to connect. There's got to be a connection. You know, you got to connect with the student that you know is struggling. And the student has to see by observation, and that's the O, by observing. You know, when there's bad behavior done, you have to help that student understand what did you do? You know, what should you have done by observing? And, you know, you have to use a code to try to get the student to change. You got to use something that is catching. And what I try to do is use catchy phrases for the student. I try to use examples that they could kind of relate to that would allow them to be the best they can be. So I use the code technique. And it was just something I made up, and I thought that would capture these students, but it's something that I've also observed, that when students have bad behavior, you have to correct it, and you have to show them by example on how to overcome that. I have a real short. I had a student who was about 13 years old in the fifth grade. He had already had a probation officer. He already had a one of those ankle braces, had a tattoo, and was terrorizing the school. And I get there, and I knew, when I saw him, okay, we're going to bump heads at some point in time. And I just waited. I mean, you know, I spoke to him, and he, you know, tried to be hard, that mask, you know, hyper-masculine. Anyway, as time went on, we bumped heads, and he, you know, he's going to try to test me, what have you. And we come to Jesus thing, and he realizes that, hey, I guess this guy's not going to take what I've been giving everybody else. Anyway, I had a way of showing them love, but also showing them discipline. People used to ask me, grown men used to ask me, and it was only a couple of men, aren't you scared of him? How do you talk to him that way? And part of the way I talked to him is, one, I had to connect with him, and I had to change some of his behavior. I couldn't change it all. But the first thing I had to do was connect with the young man. And if you don't connect with your students or the people you're trying to mentor or what have you, you're wasting your time. Sometimes they don't want anybody. But sometimes it's going to take a little while. And I think that's the biggest thing about the book. If folks read the book and realize that they're going to see a lot of examples in the book in their children or in somebody else's children. And trust me, when you connect with them, at some point in time, you can win them. And I truly believe that. So Angry Little Man, you know, it's my pride and joy. And it just came from the heart and some research. So.
Well, you know, I see thinking about benefits to women and females. As your book is based on solutions, from what I can see, and with it being based on solutions, there's going to be at least some degree of effect, success.
Yeah.
And so for every one male that's saved, I'd venture to say you have numerous females that will benefit,
yeah.
Whether it's a parent, whether it's an aunt, whether it's a spouse of the future or a girlfriend of the present. So for what you're doing, I see a direct benefit to the females to have a larger populace of male, black males, with which to be able to interface on a high level, on an intellectual level, on a progressive level.
Sure.
We are so, as a culture, as a race, desperately in need of. Desperately in need of. And that's why I focus on the African-American plight. It's not that I don't love my Asian brothers and white Caucasian brothers and Latino brothers and sisters, and all the other cultures and races. It's that I see. I don't just do the research. I live in a urban community, and I see firsthand, and I work with firsthand the plight that's going on in this community. And I know factually it's not just where I am. It's nationwide.
Okay.
And it's escalating. And so it's work like yours that are going to make a difference, a critical. I see you critical difference, because that's where we are right now. And I can't express enough how important it is that we address this in any way and always that we possibly can. And so again, I just thank you for all the efforts that you're putting forth to make this difference, because I do believe that it's going to serve a difference in our community, unparalleled, unquestionable, without any remote doubt whatsoever. So I truly do appreciate that. There's just no way I can say anything other than that. And
well,
so
thank you and your listeners as well.
And so for those of you who just tuned in or tuned in late, live or in the archives, we've had a very enlightening show. Mr. Lawrence Ham joined us, community activist, civil rights leader, to discuss the importance of getting involved, being aware of our past. As you said, Brother Porter, what an icon, living with us, for Mr. Lawrence Ham to be involved actively right now. He underscored the importance of understanding where we are and who we are as an African-American race. He mentioned four things that he wanted us to focus on, or four individuals: Kashad Ashford, Abdul Kamar, Jerome Reed. These are individuals that were murdered in the not too recent past, not too distant past, I should say, at the hands, and they were unarmed, at the hands of so-called law enforcement. And so he also mentioned the 20th anniversary of the Million Man March coming up, and the importance of being involved. Although you may question, for whatever reason, why, I don't know, that's Farrakhan, or what did they do since then? He said, if you don't go for any other reason but to stand, you know, as it says in the book that I read spiritually, that's the Holy Bible. I respect those who read the Holy Quran, or whatever other, the Kabbalah, whatever it is that a person reads for their spiritual upliftment, or if they're atheists or agnostics and just believe in love, I'm okay with that too. it just underscores the importance of being our brother's keeper. So he said that we need to understand that we have to know our history. 20th anniversary is coming up. So whether you believe it or not, that it's something that brought forth with sincerity, if you don't go for any other reason but just to stand, and in the book that I read, the Holy Bible, it says sometimes you stand and then you just got to stand some more. And he mentioned those 9 African Americans that were murdered if you don't go for any other reason but just to stand and say, I abhor that. This isn't about necessarily just Farrakhan, and he's saying some great things you may say. Or you may say, I agree with everything. Or you may say, I don't agree with anything. But I'm coming down here in solidarity for the African-American race, for what is going on in this country under the leadership of an African-American president. Not to point the fingers, don't misunderstand, but to say, even with an African-American president, we are worse off today than we were 5 years ago, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, 8 years ago, 10 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago. But at least in the last 20 years, because by some standards, there were those that would say, we're doing better. I would disagree with that. And then he said, if you don't do anything but stand to make a statement against the epidemic of police murders since 1995, the last time there was a march, just go for that. Bring your sign. Black Lives Matter. So there are those that poo-poo that, Black Lives Matter. You know, those on Fox, I know, one of the hosts, I don't give them any energy or any airplay, so I'm not mentioning his name, said, I'm going to tear down Black Lives Matter. Well, Black Lives do matter. And because a police officer was shot and killed, and I feel for his family and his loved ones. I do. I don't want to see anyone be murdered. I think it's wrong. But that doesn't take away from the fact that Black Lives Matter. So I say to him on Fox, you're foolish. You're foolish. I'm not going to say you're a fool. That's not for me to determine. But you're foolish to make a statement like, oh, anyone who will come up with Black Lives Matter is terrible. All lives matter. No, the statement is Black Lives Matter. So if I say I like an apple, does that mean that I don't like oranges? So it was a foolish, foolish statement. He's a foolish person. But it shows you have foolish people making millions of dollars. So we need to stand, folks. It's time for us to stand. And I do believe if we stand, and we stand in solidarity, there'll be a synergy. There'll be a synergy that will pervade all of us in some form or fashion. Similar to the way Jesus fed 5,000 with a loaf of bread. Stand. And let the energy show what can come out of that. So we thank Mr. Lawrence Ham, and then a tough act to follow, but Mr. Dr. Porter came on and broke it down for us in terms of the importance of getting involved, the criticality of getting involved, talking about how our children are angry little men are really just boys, big boys, express hyper-masculinity. And he said, let's challenge these children because they want to be challenged and need to be challenged. So we thank Mr. Kevin Porter again for joining us. I look forward to us coming back together again. The book is Angry Little Men, Hypermasculinity, Academic Disconnect, and Mentoring African-American Males by Mr. Kevin Porter. And that book focuses on solutions. And even though he talks about mentoring African-American males, all of society will benefit, not just African-American males and African-American women and girls, but all of society. Because for any segment of our society to fall out or fall behind in mass is an affront on the entire society. I ask that you tell someone about Progressive News Weekly. There was we had Ron Crenshaw scheduled to join us this evening, and so I was waiting to have him join us, and I'm hoping that Ron can join us at the next program that we're going to have, because in that we were looking to have him participate, and Ron is truly a friend of Progressive News Weekly on a political front. Ron, I see, has come into studio. I'm going to just ask if he can possibly join us on our next program, because Ron, he brings it straightforward, and as they say, straight, no chaser. I see that he's joined us a little bit later in the program. I wasn't able to bridge him in at that time. And I see that he's just joined us. Ron, I'm going to ask, is it possible that you can join us on our next program and maybe open up for us? I would truly appreciate that.
Yes,
I do appreciate
thank you.
Ron,
thank you.
For those of you who are on the archives, I'm going to ask that you you listen to last week's program.
Last week, okay.
I'm going to ask, and you want to specifically tune in to what Ron had to share with us about the 911 incident.
Yes.
And we're going to pick up on that when Ron joins us on the next program that we air. So that will prime you for the next program, listeners. Listen in. That would be for the week of September 10th. Listen to the program, and you'll hear what Ron had to share with you that most people have no clue of with regard to 911 and some things happening in our society. And then when Ron joins us on our next program, I'm going to elaborate on some of the aftermath that he found out in one of the events following the anniversary, the 14th anniversary. Would you do that for us, Ron?
Yes, sir. I will do my utmost. Okay.
I appreciate.
I will do that. I will strive to be articulate and, you know, down to earth with a summation around 9/11. Sure.
That would be so helpful.
That's right. Sure.
Well, with
all right. Thank you.
With that said, thank you, Ron. With that said,
okay.
We're closing out another edition of Progressive News Weekly. We thank you, the listener, for tuning in. I'm going to ask that you share Progressive News Weekly with someone. Tell them to tune in to Progressive News Weekly. And send me an email. Let me know topics and or guests that you believe would bring information or news to the masses that they don't typically or we don't typically hear on mainstream. And so the next time that we come together, we'll be into autumn. So I wish everyone a happy autumn as we will meet again next week. And understand, the best is yet to come. As we come together. And until next week, tell someone about Progressive News. Tell someone whom you love that you love them. And keep it real. Share the information. Sharing is caring. And so I leave you with, the best is yet to come.
Give you the moonlight. Show me your smile, I'll feel it with